Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Endometrial Cancer. And we are today we are partnering with Share Cancer Support on this program today, and later you'll hear more about the services that they offer as well. And today's program is supported by ISI Inc. and GlaxoSmithKline. I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, we have many of you on the program today. There are over 300 participants on this program today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, Egypt, Ghana, India, Laos, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And we're delighted with all of you being on the call. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine, recipient of ASCO Hologic Mentor Award. And Dr. Runowitz will be addressing an overview of endometrial cancer, including diagnosing and staging, current standard of care and clinical trials, how research increases treatment options. It's now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you. I am honored to be included in this impressive panel. I am a gynecologic oncologist by training, which means that I perform surgery and then following surgery, make an evaluation of what are the best treatments, if any, are needed. I've been asked to review the background of endometrial cancer. Cancer of the endometrium is the most common gynecologic malignancy in developed countries and the second most common in developing countries. The presenting symptom is usually postmenopausal bleeding, and the diagnosis is usually made by an office endometrial biopsy. However, the biopsy may also be in the operating room and accompanied by a hysteroscopy, which is a scope that looks at the inside of the endometrium. Following the biopsy, preoperative before surgery imaging studies may be performed in patients with tumors that are other than well-differentiated endometrial cancer. And Dr. Kerr will be going over the pathology following this talk. The surgical management of endometrial cancer includes removal of the uterus, the ovaries, fallopian tubes, and lymph node sampling in patients with advanced or high-grade endometrial cancers. Sentinel lymph node mapping, as you may know from breast cancer, has been utilized to identify nodes by looking first at the sentinel node to see if it is positive or negative. If it's surgery, extensive disease is noted, an attempt at surgical cytoreduction, and that is to remove all visible tumor by a gynecologic oncologist may be performed. An obentectomy may also be performed in certain histologic subtypes. The surgery is usually done with minimally invasive techniques, for example, robotic or laparoscopic surgery, so that patients can be discharged in either the day of surgery or more commonly the day after or the following day after surgery. Endometrial cancer is surgically staged, and the surgical stage is assigned to the patients based on the findings at surgery and the pathology. The FIGO staging system is the most commonly employed staging system, and a stage is assigned to the patient depending on the extent of disease, which includes pathologic assessment of lymph nodes, the uterus and cervical involvement, and any distant disease. The type and grade of tumor is determined by the pathologist. In all stages, the grade of the lesion, the histological type, and lymphovascular space invasion is recorded. Molecular classification testing has been introduced, and there are several types: the POLE mutation, the MMR or mismatch repair, microsatellite instability, and P53 abnormal. These are important in determining the prognostic risk group and as factors that might influence the choice of adjuvant as treatment after surgery and systemic treatment decisions. Dr. Kerr will discuss the pathology in more detail and the molecular subtyping, prognosis and classification, and its impact on choice of treatment. Knowing the molecular subtypes may be important for clinical trials and also perhaps to evaluate the genetics, for example, in a syndrome called HNPCC or hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer. Once the pathology has been reported, a treatment plan will be recommended. This is often done and best done at a multidisciplinary tumor board, which usually includes a gynecologic oncologist, a pathologist, medical and radiation oncologist, as well as social workers and other support teams, so that a comprehensive treatment plan can be considered and made available to the patient. Radiation therapy, either external, that is the machines are external to the patient, or vaginal, where the radiation is given intravaginal, may be used in patients with invasion of the muscle of the uterus or myometrial invasion, involvement of the cervix, high-grade tumors, or advanced stage disease, which is confined to the pelvis. And as I said, radiation may be external from the radiation machines or intravaginal. Several trials have been done combining chemotherapy and pelvic radiation. Chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel are the most prescribed chemotherapies in these settings at this time. It is, however, important to consider clinical trials and determine treatment on the basis of molecular characteristics, which we're going to hear more from Dr. Kerr, and extent of disease or the stage of the disease. If postoperative treatments are recommended, there is always an option for a second opinion, and in my opinion, should be exercised. One option is to enroll in a clinical trial. Clinical trials are research studies performed in patients that are aimed at evaluating a medical, surgical, or behavioral intervention. They are the primary way that researchers find out if a new treatment, like a new drug, is effective. If standard treatments have not worked, I highly recommend that patients consider a clinical trial. Now, how does one go about finding a clinical trial? Oftentimes, your treating doctor will have somebody that can help you, but clinicaltrials.gov, and again, I'll repeat it, clinicaltrials.gov is a database of privately and publicly funded clinical studies around the world. You can get access to new and novel therapies by locating them on this site and contacting the investigators. I'm sure that Dr. McCann will go into more details on these therapies. Once your therapy is concluded, postoperative surveillance usually consists of exams every 3 to 6 months for about 2 years, unless there are symptoms. Genetic counseling is recommended, as I've noted, in patients with a history suggestive of HNPCC or hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer. Another name is Lynch syndrome. There is limited role for imaging studies in an asymptomatic patient. 70% of endometrial recurrences are associated with symptoms. That concludes my overall discussion, and I turn it back to Dr. Mesner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was really an outstanding, a stellar presentation, and really you set the stage for today's program. So I want to thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Georgia McCain, and Dr. McCain is Associate Professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Chief Division of Gynecologic Oncology, University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio. And Dr. McCain will be addressing new treatments for metastatic endometrial cancer, new treatment approaches, including the role of precision medicine, targeted treatments, and immunotherapy, and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and quality of life concerns and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. McCain.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I am a GYN oncologist at UT Health San Antonio, and again, grateful for the opportunity today. Today, I will speak about new treatments for metastatic endometrial cancer and the role of precision medicine and targeted therapies. Most women with endometrial cancer are diagnosed at an early stage. However, there are a subset of patients that have metastatic disease at the time of initial diagnosis or those who experience recurrence after initial treatment. Metastatic means that the endometrial cancer has spread outside of the uterus to different organs. This can include lymph nodes, liver, lungs, or the peritoneal lining of the abdomen. Treatment of newly diagnosed metastatic endometrial cancer usually involves multiple modalities or types of treatment. Some patients are eligible for surgical cytoreduction, meaning they have a surgery that removes all visible cancer. Surgery is not typically recommended for patients who experience recurrent endometrial cancer that is metastatic. All patients, whether they have a surgery or not, will receive systemic therapy. The standard systemic therapy for metastatic endometrial cancer is cytotoxic chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel. Sometimes there will be an additional medication added to this treatment depending on the genetic makeup of the cancer. Physicians use precision medicine to determine if patients will benefit from adding other medications to standard chemotherapy. Precision medicine, or next-generation sequencing, uses the cancer's genetic makeup to guide treatment decisions. This means that a tumor biopsy is sent to a lab where the tumor's DNA is sequenced and specific protein analysis is performed. Knowing the DNA sequence and specific mutations helps oncologists identify targeted therapy options for women with metastatic endometrial cancer. Immunotherapy can be considered a type of targeted therapy. For example, patients with mismatch repair deficient or microsatellite instability high metastatic endometrial cancers are more likely to benefit from the addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy. One of the main reasons why the body can't fight cancers on its own is that the body doesn't recognize the cancer as abnormal and therefore doesn't know to attack it. Endometrial cancers that are mismatch repair deficient have lost the ability to fix mistakes in their own DNA. This results in a big commotion of DNA replication and creation of more proteins that the body doesn't recognize as normal. The more abnormal proteins there are, the more likely the body's immune system is to recognize and attack these cancer cells. There have been two practice-changing clinical trials published in the last year for treatment of metastatic endometrial cancer. These trials demonstrated benefit of adding immunotherapy to chemotherapy in subsets of patients with metastatic endometrial cancer, especially those whose tumors are mismatch repair deficient. Oncologists also use precision medicine to identify patients who may be eligible for medications such as trastuzumab or trastuzumab deruxtecan. These medications can be used in certain metastatic endometrial cancers that overexpress a protein called HER2-NU. Women with metastatic endometrial cancer will often experience symptoms due to the cancer. These include, but are not limited to, pain, fatigue, weight loss, swelling, and loss of appetite. In addition to this, the treatment of metastatic endometrial cancer has numerous side effects. Side effects of chemotherapy can include hair loss, nausea, vomiting, body or joint pain, neuropathy, and fatigue. Women receiving immunotherapy can experience additional side effects that affect the intestines, thyroid gland, lungs, liver, and skin. It is also very common for patients diagnosed with cancer to experience depression. It is important to communicate any bothersome symptoms to your oncology team. There are different interventions that can be trialed depending on the symptoms a patient is experiencing. Some, but not all, of the interventions include medications. I personally find that patients benefit from having an oncology team that includes their treating oncologists, nurses, social workers, and other support. Additionally, women may benefit from seeing a palliative care team. Again, this is a team of physicians, nurses, and other supporting services whose focus is helping women manage symptoms they are experiencing either due to the cancer or its treatment. Metastatic cancer can sometimes cause severe pain that requires narcotic medication. It is normal to feel hesitant about taking pain medication. However, I remind my patients that they have real pain and the intent of the medication is to help them function and live as normal a life as possible. Sleepiness can be a side effect of pain medication. Tell your physician if you feel the medication is making you too tired. It is important for women to maintain quality of life as they go through cancer treatment. Providers can help with that. When patients and doctors work together to make decisions, it is called shared decision making. People who take part in shared decision making are more likely to get the care they want and feel overall satisfied. Patients are the experts for their body. It is important to ask questions and talk openly about what is most important. For example, patients may want to delay or skip a treatment to travel or participate in a family event. In most instances, treatment schedules can be adjusted. Examples like this are ways in which the patient and oncologist can participate in shared decision-making to help meet the patient's goals. I encourage every patient to have an honest relationship with their oncologist and ask as many questions as possible. It is important for us to know how you are feeling and what your goals are. We are here to support you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. McCain. That was really outstanding. Really just a wonderful presentation and stellar. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Sarah Kerr. Dr. Kerr is a pathologist with Hospital Pathology Associates, Division of Cytopathology, Pulmonary Gynecologic, and Molecular Pathology, Alina Health Laboratories, Alina Healthcare Institute. And Dr. Kerr will be addressing the important role of the pathologist, how genetic and biomarker testing inform treatment decisions for endometrial cancer, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm so excited to go into more depth about pathology and new biomarkers in endometrial cancer. The endometrial cancer biomarkers and pathology have definitely had some exciting new developments that have been in research for several years and now are just starting to be used in practice. So first of all, I am a pathologist, which is a doctor who specializes in laboratory testing. In endometrial cancer, your pathologist is involved in your care behind the scenes. Many of you had an endometrial biopsy at the beginning of your cancer journey, and that endometrial biopsy goes to the pathology laboratory where the tissue is processed into little wax blocks, cut into thin sections, and then put on glass slides to look at under a microscope. The pathologist recognizes whether there is cancer in the endometrium or something else that might be causing abnormal vaginal bleeding, like abnormal menstrual cycles or a benign polyp. If there is cancer, the pathologist needs to make sure it is coming from the endometrium and not from somewhere else nearby, like the cervix, because treatments are very different for those cancers. If it is endometrial cancer, there are a number of types and grades of endometrial cancer that are important. A cancer called FIGO grade 1 endometrioid carcinoma, for example, is usually a slow-growing cancer that could potentially be treated with an intrauterine device or progesterone pills if the cancer is caught early and there is a need to delay surgery due to poor health, or in younger patients wanting to keep their uterus to potentially try for a child in the future. This being said, most endometrial cancers after childbearing is complete or if invasive on imaging are managed with surgery, as we have heard about from the prior speakers. Endometrioid carcinoma, clear cell carcinoma, serous carcinoma, or carcinosarcoma are types of endometrial cancer, and they are always, almost always managed with surgery if possible. When a surgery is performed, that tissue removed by the surgeon is also sent to the pathology laboratory, where a team led by the pathologist examines the tissue with the naked eye, which is called gross examination, and under a microscope. A pathologist report is made with the final tumor diagnosis and a staging report describing how far the cancer has spread. Something new that you might be reading about in your pathology reports is the molecular classification of endometrial cancer. Pathologists for years have classified endometrial cancer with a microscope only and some special stains that are looked at under a microscope. But now there are molecular tests that can be used to help provide even better information about endometrial cancer beyond what we can tell just by looking under the microscope. The most common tests now are POLE mutation testing, that's spelled P-O-L-E mutation, mismatch repair enzymes, sometimes called short MMR, and P53 status. That's P53, or sometimes the gene is called TP53. These three tests for a tumor can be, after these three tests, a tumor can be given a molecular classification. You might hear this called the PROMIS classifier, which stands for Proactive Molecular Risk Classifier for Endometrial Cancer. The molecular classification divides cancers into POLE mutant, or also called ultra mutated, mismatch repair deficient, or also called microsatellite instability high, P53 abnormal, or also called serous-like or copy number high, or having no specific molecular profile. So the first one I talked about, POLE mutant tumors, make up only about 5% of endometrial cancers, so relatively uncommon. They have a defect in accurately copying DNA, leading to the tumor accumulating a huge number of mistakes in the DNA, which is why they are called ultra-mutated or high tumor mutation burden tumors. This is thought that these mistakes in the tumor make the tumor more recognizable to the immune system, and therefore some of these POLE mutant tumors may be easier to treat because the body itself is using the immune system to contain the tumor. POLE mutant tumors can be high grade under the microscope, but may not behave so aggressively as they look. Your oncologist may take this into consideration in your treatment plan if you have a POLE mutant tumor, or may recommend a clinical trial for you. Mismatch repair deficient tumors are a second category of tumors that I'll talk about that are similar to POLE mutant tumors in that an enzyme needed to fix mistakes during DNA replication isn't working correctly in the tumor. These tumors are called microsatellite unstable, which describes the specific types of mistakes in the DNA of the tumor. The number of mutations in mismatch repair deficient tumors is not as high as in the POLE mutant tumor category, but they still have a relatively high tumor mutation burden, and the immune system can still recognize the differences in the tumor from the normal body cells. And this can be used to help treat mismatch repair deficient tumors with a relatively new therapy over the last few years called immunotherapy. Some mismatch repair deficient tumors are found in patients with Lynch syndrome, which means there is a familial mutation in a gene associated with hereditary endometrial cancers, colon cancers, and some other tumors. So some patients with mismatch repair deficient tumors will undergo genetic testing, such as for Lynch syndrome, to determine if they have this mutation in the family. This is really important because patients and families with Lynch syndrome can undergo special screening and surgeries to catch cancers early or prevent cancers from starting in other family members. The third molecular type that I'll talk about for endometrial cancer is called P53 abnormal. These are usually serous carcinomas under the microscope or carcinosarcomas, but sometimes the tumor under the microscope can look like endometrioid or clear cell carcinoma, which are other histologic subtypes or under the microscope types of cancer that can still be P53 abnormal by molecular testing. P53 abnormal tumors tend to behave aggressively, so your oncologist may consider more aggressive treatment if you have a P53 abnormal tumor, or they may recommend a clinical trial. Serous carcinomas and P53 abnormal tumors sometimes have a positive marker called HER2. When serous carcinomas are positive for HER2, they produce too much of the HER2 protein due to having too many copies of the gene. HER2 positive tumors can then potentially be treated with targeted therapy similar to what is used for HER2 positive breast cancers. And then there's the fourth molecular subtype, which is the rest of endometrial cancers that have no specific molecular profile. And these cancers with no specific molecular profile are actually the most common type of endometrial cancer. They tend to be endometrioid carcinomas under the microscope, and we still have just a lot to learn about this group of cancers. Most of the time, these cancers are estrogen receptor positive, and your oncologist can discuss with you using hormone-altering medicines to help control the tumor growth, especially if the tumor is slow-growing or recurs after standard treatments like chemotherapy or radiation therapy. There are also new therapy regimens for progressive endometrial cancers that are mostly in this no specific molecular profile category. If you have what is called mismatch repair proficient endometrial cancer, so we had talked about mismatch repair deficient or loss of mismatch repair, if mismatch repair is intact or proficient in an endometrial cancer that has progressed on standard chemotherapy, your oncologist, based on that biomarker, may discuss a newer therapy called lenvatinib, which is a kinase inhibitor given in combination with immune therapy, which we had talked about for other cancer types, called pembrolizumab or Keytruda. Okay, so that was a lot about endometrial cancer pathology. Endometrial cancer has gotten very complicated in terms of all the therapy options available, but having all of those options is just a really good thing for patients. So finally, I will give some tips about electronic medical records and communicating with your team virtually between in-person appointments. A lot of your medical records and communications with doctors is online now, and this technology has greatly improved during the COVID pandemic. This technology works on smartphones or on a regular computer or laptop. And if you have an online portal to your medical records, sometimes it's called Open Notes or by other names, this portal can basically make test results and CT scans available to you immediately online, even before your oncologist has had a chance to see them. So for my healthcare, I've gotten pop-up messages on my phone telling me there is a result to go and view online, and you may have experienced that. This is because there was a change in the law to make these records available to you right away as soon as they're released. So this can be very empowering to have this transparency, to have those results right away, but it can also be very scary and confusing when you want to know what the reports mean and you can't reach your doctor right away, say on a weekend. Work with your team on this to have a communication plan about your test results and be prepared for what to expect in terms of when you receive them. You can often send a message to your team with questions and concerns right from your phone or computer, and they can send back a message through the online portal. And this can be a great way to keep in touch with your cancer care team between in-person and virtual telehealth appointments. You might have a prepared list of questions to ask in person or during your telehealth visits that are set up remotely through the computer or through your phone, and you forgot to ask something from that list. But now you can send a message if you have that online portal access with the question to follow up if you forgot to ask something. I do this with my doctors, too, for my healthcare, and it really works great having that electronic access through your phone or through your computer. Okay, that's all I have for today. Thanks so much for listening in to what I have had to say to you. I'm turning the conference back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was really outstanding and just a wonderful presentation and just really lots of invaluable information for our participants. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Ms. Corby Arthur, and Ms. Arthur is Uterine Cancer Patient Support Coordinator, Share Cancer Support. And Ms. Arthur will be addressing Share Cancer Support's free programs and services, and will be giving you information about the National Helpline number and their website. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Arthur, who is representing Share Cancer Support as a partner organization on this program today.
Hello, and thank you so much for the kind introduction, Carolyn. We are very pleased to have the opportunity to partner with Cancer Care on today's educational program. Share supports endometrial/uterine cancer patients, as well as breast, ovarian, and cervical cancer patients. And our services are offered in Chinese and Spanish languages, as well as in English. We have four peer-led uterine cancer support groups, and that are currently held via Zoom or telephone. A general uterine cancer support meets twice a month. Newly diagnosed and in treatment group meets twice a month. Women of African descent meets once a month. Young women's gynecological cancers meets once a month. We have a helpline that is staffed by trained uterine cancer survivors who can lend support and give information and share experiences. The number for the helpline is 844-582-6005. We have educational programs that are monthly, and but we also have additional programs throughout the year, including events like today's, where we partner with other organizations. SHARE provides the latest information on uterine and endometrial cancer research and treatment, as well as strategies for maintaining well-being and quality of life from the top oncologists and experts in their fields. Most webinars are recorded. We also have exercise classes led online, and you can sign up for our bi-monthly newsletter on our website and receive information about all our programs as well as research updates. Some of our partner organizations are Health Unlocked, which is an online forum. Bagit and Shared created a special uterine cancer bag, which has information for patients and caregivers. And Share and Emerging Med offer a personalized clinical trial matching service that is free and confidential. We also have a nutritional support from Save Our Health, which is in the form of an app. And for more information on all our uterine cancer programs, you can visit us at sharecancersupport.org, or if you have any questions, you can email us at uterineprogram@sharecancersupport.org. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Arthur. That was excellent and a wonderful resource for everybody on the call today. So please do take advantage of the resources that that Share Cancer Support offers to a wide variety of people and in multiple languages as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Samantha Fortune. Ms. Fortune is an oncology social worker, and she is a Women's Cancers Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Fortune will be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services, and will give you information about our Hope Line and our website as well. Now, it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Fortune.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Sam Fortune, and I am the Women's Cancers Program Coordinator, as well as an oncology social worker at CancerCare. CancerCare is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional supportive services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation services, counseling, support groups, educational workshops like this today, publications, and limited financial assistance. In my role at CancerCare, I provide supportive services to individuals and their families impacted by cancer diagnosis, as well as develop programs and initiatives for our Women's Cancer Department. Individuals diagnosed with endometrial cancer may choose to supplement existing social networks by either joining a support group or engaging in counseling services. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services as well. Being a member in a support group particularly can offer the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences as you are, obtain information, and provide support. Currently, CancerCare offers Pacific GYN cancer support groups online. The GYN cancer support groups aim to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources, and address ways to communicate with your medical team or your loved ones. Our online support group takes place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who can offer further support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and group members must register to join. You can register for an online support group through our website at cancercare.org by selecting our services, then support groups. After completing the registration process on our website, members will have access to participate in our group, and our group is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Individuals also may experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment. Please know that if you're encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help you. CancerCare's Resource Navigation Services offer a short-term strength-based approach service to both patients and caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the patient in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about the supportive services we offer at CancerCare, I encourage you to call our National Hope Line at 800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. At CancerCare, our oncology social workers are trained in how an endometrial cancer diagnosis can impact an individual as well as their loved ones. We are here to offer you support throughout this experience, and we look forward to hearing from you. It has been such a pleasure to be part of this program. Thank you so much for your attention. I will now turn the program back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Fortune. That was outstanding, and it's a wonderful resource for everybody on this call today, so please do take advantage of these resources. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and I try to take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Dr. McCain. Are there any recommendations for patients undergoing immunotherapy regarding COVID?
There are no specific recommendations. I think it usually winds up being a case-by-case basis depending on the timing of the diagnosis of COVID and their symptoms.
Excellent, thank you. And another question for Dr. Runowitz. What's being done to train doctors to diagnose endometrial cancer? My oncologist ignored my bleeding symptoms even though I had been on tamoxifen for years. Now I'm dying.
That's a tough question or a tough history. I'm sorry about your experience. Pretty much in medical school, one learns, and all medical students learn this in pathology and when they rotate through the OBGYN clinical clerkship, that postmenopausal bleeding is something that needs to be investigated. Or if there's bleeding that's abnormal for a premenopausal patient, such as bleeding in between periods. And certainly on tamoxifen, if you're bleeding based on the NSABP data, That data show that symptomatic patients should be biopsied. Asymptomatic patients did not need it. So I'm sorry about your experience. I can't specifically speak to your treatments, but if you may be eligible for a clinical trial, and we've seen spectacular results in some of the immunotherapy treatments, and so I strongly urge you to access the clinical trial website. It's clinicaltrials.gov. And then you heard from our associates that the share will help you navigate the clinical trials. It can be hard, difficult for somebody without medical experience, but if you've got a navigator helping you, you will benefit.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And we are so sorry about this experience that you've had, and please do feel free to reach out also to Cancer Care for support as well. So another question for Dr. McCain, is it possible for endometrial cancer to be mixed endometrioid, serous, and clear cell?
Yes, that is, that can happen. Not uncommonly. When it does happen, we usually treat for the most aggressive histology, which would be the serous and clear cell histology.
And it's a question again for Dr. McCain. How does the new FIGO rating stage and grade affect those who were previously rated?
It's a great question. We don't go back and typically restage patients who have already been diagnosed, staged, and treated historically. And the use of the new staging system hasn't been universally implemented yet across the board. Some institutions are doing it, and so there, it's still in the process of being laid out. So the short answer is it should not affect patients who have been previously diagnosed or treated.
Thank you. For Dr. Runowitz, do you ever see patients changing from microsatellite stable to microsatellite unstable or the reverse?
That's a good question. We have seen what's called tumor heterogeneity in, say, for example, a primary tumor versus a metastatic. So just looking at something like ER-positive tumors in the endometrium, and you look at a metastatic site, and it'll be ER-negative. So you can see what we call tumor cell heterogeneity in the different sites. So, it's important that when you get the pathology that you have all this information about what the primary showed, what the metastatic showed, and then what the next best treatment is.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. McCain, would you advise perimenopausal women begin oral or vaginal birth control as a preventive measure for endometrial cancer? Is the answer dependent upon family history?
We actually recommend against the use of hormonal kind of contraception or even hormone replacement therapy. It can be very specific and tailored. Women who still have a uterus on hormones absolutely need to be on a combination of both estrogen and progesterone if they are on hormonal therapy, and there are risks and benefits associated with that. So we typically don't recommend hormonal treatment as a preventative strategy, but rather recommend discussion with your primary gynecologist and really focusing on signs or symptoms that are concerning for endometrial cancer, very similar to what was discussed earlier, like abnormal bleeding either during periods or between periods and any bleeding that happens after menopause.
Excellent, thank you. And another question for Dr. Runowitz, does staging change after recurrence?
No. Your stage is your stage. So if you develop a recurrence, we talk about it as endometrial cancer with recurrence, but your stage that you were originally staged at stays the same. And that kind of goes to the point of biology is really destiny, so that the staging is important because it tells you at that moment a picture in time. But I think what's really important is the molecular pathology, and you work hand in glove with your pathologist trying to figure out whether the tumor is aggressive or whether the tumor is a tumor that's not going to recur. And this is done through the receptors, the hormone receptors, looking at the molecular MMR or mismatch repair deficient, the MSI high. And based on that information, you will get what we call adjuvant treatment, which will be treatment after your surgery. Now, in the recurrent setting, your stage does not change, but if you can get a tissue diagnosis, then you can, again, do that molecular testing and come up with a treatment plan or a clinical trial that best fits you.
Excellent. Thank you. These are wonderful questions, I must say. So, after McCain, how can I distinguish if a pain symptom is normal, a side effect of treatment, or related to cancer?
That's another great question. In terms of whether or not it's related to cancer, what I usually tell patients is that any symptom that is due to cancer recurrence or progression usually persists or gets worse over time. And you'll try the usual for whatever the symptom it may be, and then it may get a little bit better, but then it comes right back and or it gets worse or it doesn't get better at all. Those are symptoms that I tell patients are most concerning for cancer. The other thing I like to tell patients is that once you have a cancer diagnosis, I personally found that a lot of my patients, they really kind of are in tune with their body and their symptoms. So I'll have patients most times come in and tell me just something doesn't feel right. And they may not be able to pinpoint a specific symptom, but they know their body and they know something's not right. In terms of distinguishing symptoms related to treatment versus cancer, I think that is dependent on the treatment that you are receiving and the timing of the symptom in relation to treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. So this question for Dr. Ronowitz, why does a woman who is postmenopausal experience hot flashes after a full hysterectomy?
So that's a great question. Not every woman, but when women stop menstruating, it means that the hormone estrogen is decreasing and is no longer able to stimulate the uterus to make a period or a bleed. So that's basically the basis for hot flashes. So when the estrogen level is low, the brain it perceives the estrogen level being low and sends off hot flashes. The good news is that there are now new therapies for hot flashes that are not hormonal. So, for example, in patients with breast cancer or patients even with endometrial or uterine cancer may not want to take hormonal therapies. In the old days, the best treatment for hot flashes was clearly hands down estrogen. But now there are new drugs that understand the central basis of hot flashes. And so this is something that you should discuss with your doctor, or if your doctor has a nurse practitioner or a PA or an office nurse, they can give you good advice on how to treat a hot flash.
Excellent. Thank you. And this will be the last question for Dr. McCain. How does one deal with long-term treatment side effects, GI issues from, for example, GI issues from radiation?
That is another great question. It depends on the severity and the type of symptoms that the patient is having. Oftentimes, the long-term side effects of radiation is chronic intermittent diarrhea. That can sometimes be easily managed with addition of fiber supplements to the diet or use of antidiarrheals. If it's really severe, then I will sometimes have a patient see a gastroenterologist for additional help in supporting the patient.
Excellent. And so now I'm going to ask actually if people would, if our speakers would provide just a takeaway from today's program, and we'll do it in the order that you presented. So Dr. Runowitz first, Dr. McCain second, Ms. Arthur third, and Ms. Fortune fourth. So Dr. Runowitz,
great.
Do you want to go first with just a takeaway, what people you'd like people to take away from today's program?
I think the biggest takeaway is this is a team sport, that you have a surgeon who is trained, a GYN oncologist who's trained, and not only the surgical management, but also the postoperative management. But at these tumor conferences is also a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, a pathologist, and this team puts together what is the best treatment in the individual circumstance of the tumor grade, tumor stage, and the characteristics which you heard about. So I'd say it's a team sport.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. McCain?
Yeah, I would say for me the takeaway is really being in tune with your symptoms and really developing a open relationship with your oncologist and your oncology team. To help manage any symptoms, questions, or concerns that you have.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Arthur?
Hi. The SHARE has so many things to offer for patients, and we have a lot of peer support, and I forgot to give you the helpline number, which is 844-582-6005, and we're happy to help you.
Thank you. And Ms. Fortune?
I would say going through a cancer diagnosis is very, very stressful. And as everyone's mentioned, it's a team, and you shouldn't be doing this alone. And please note that there's a lot of support, whether it's counselors, patient navigators, family and friends. So don't feel afraid to reach out. There's always guidance for you, and you don't have to navigate through this journey alone.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. Wow, this has been an amazing program. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. This has been a phenomenal program. And I want to thank our participants for asking such great questions. And I also want to thank our speakers for really, really giving such wonderful answers. It was just, we've done a program on this topic before, but I have to say this program was just incredibly wonderful. That's all I can say. And I also would like to go over, not everybody got, we couldn't answer all of your questions, so I do want to say something about that. For those of you who asked a question, for those of you who have a question that you're in queue to ask, and for those who are thinking of a question, I would recommend that all of you go back to your treating healthcare team. They do know you the best, and you've learned some things today that you can bring back to your healthcare team, which make your questions perhaps a little bit more knowledgeable, and you probably feel more confident asking the questions that you have. And so please do go back to your healthcare team for your questions that you may have, even if you asked a question. And also because they would be able to tailor the question to you because they have your chart in front of them. They know everything about you. Also, we would not want anyone to feel alone when you leave this program today. We want you to now feel you're part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you. And your healthcare team consists of many different people. Both your treating oncologist, your radiation oncologist, your oncology nurse, oncology social worker, patient navigator, financial navigator. They have all these different people on that team. And you can ask your physician a question, and they will relate you to somebody on the team who can help you if it's not a question for them. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.